Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Poolside Pass podcast. On today's episode, we're going to be speaking about lactate testing in swimming. Jonathan Hart, curator of our parent podcast, teamed up with Swim T to discuss all things lactate testing and biochemistry in swimming. Before we get into the main topic for today's episode, is a quick line from our sponsors, Streamlined. Become a qualified swimming teacher with Streamlined in as little as 6 days. Learn at your own pace and be guided by our expert tutors. You can do your training face-to-face, online in real-time, or a combination of the two. Assessment can be in your club using videos or attending one of our assessment venues. We offer tailored, high-quality support. Quote the Poolside Pass for an extra 10% discount.
Hi, Thanasi. Welcome to you, Frederick.
Hi. Nice to be with you today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
SwimT's goal is to set off the abundant information provided by sports scientists and swimming coaches. Thanasi, you're an exercise biochemist and swim coach, which is a fascinating job title, and we're going to come on to that in a minute.
Thank you.
Our main topic today, everyone, is we want to look at how research can assist training, and additionally how biochemical, for example, lactate monitoring can assist training and help swimming performance to improve. Let's start, Thanasi, by really sort of at the beginning, really, with asking you exactly what is an exercise biochemist, and secondly, really, how that symbiotically works with your work as a swim coach on a day-to-day basis.
Yes. Well, an exercise biochemist is someone who studies the effects of exercise and training on biochemical markers. In other words, it's someone who is monitoring biomarkers in active people and athletes, aiming to understand the effects of exercise and training, and then to improve training by giving guidance and suggestions according to the changes or fluctuations found in these biomarkers. The aim is to improve performance, to prevent health issues, obviously. And, you know, there are a lot of fascinating and complicated biochemical functions in our bodies. And we really have to, you know, take all these things happening in our body and understand what all these changes, all the concentrations of these parameters mean to us, and then help coaches and swimmers, athletes in general. Swimmers are our interest. So it's about helping active people and athletes improve their performance by understanding the biochemical, the changes happening in our body during exercise. Exercise biochemists maybe work in research settings, in academic positions, doing research on this kind of things, or in applied settings, actually working with athletes and coaches, monitoring biochemical parameters in acute exercise settings or in long-term, the long-term effects of training on biochemical markers, and then make out what really works best for the athletes according to the interpretation of these results.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And you obviously a swim coach, head coach of a club in Greece on a day-to-day basis as well.
Yes. Well, to present myself better so somebody can understand, I was a competitive swimmer. Then I studied sports science. I have a bachelor in sports science, a bachelor degree. Then my master and my PhD were on human performance and health. And during all these years, my research was focused in exercise biochemistry, and in particular in swimming, in competitive swimmers, because it was my job from then to be a swim coach. And then as I progressed to postdoctoral research, I kept on, digging deeper and deeper on the effects of exercise in biochemical markers and how swimming training or how the swimmer's bodies react to the training stimuli from the biochemical point of view, and you really get a lot of information. So yes, my main job, if I can call it that way, all these years was to be a swimming coach, but I'm an active researcher in exercise biochemistry, and my love for swimming has provided me the chance to have the ability to study swimmers, to study swimming training, to study the effects of swimming training on biochemical markers, on mostly blood biomarkers. And this information have, widened my knowledge and helped me to help other coaches, since I collaborate with coaches to providing guidance after, obviously, biochemical testing.
That's a fascinating job that you've
Thank
got there.
You very much. I really like it, at least.
Yeah, keeps you on your toes. Can we just perhaps get a little bit of an explanation of the work that SWIMT, for listeners out there, SWIMT is SSWIMT, and what work that SWIMT does around the world to assist swimming coaching and relevant sports scientists to keep up to date with swimming research progress?
Yes, it was something that I wanted really to find on the internet. It would help me a lot, so I started it myself and with help of other people. Being a full-time coach, it's really time demanding. A coach has to be on deck and coaching his or her swimmers, has to do managerial stuff, has to travel for competitions, for training camps. It's really time consuming, and it's really hard to keep up to date with all the new research that comes up. So this research has to be more easily diverted to the people who actually apply all the findings on athletes and have to really understand them and use them afterwards. So I tried to make something really clear, simple, really simple. Take the abstracts of papers focused on swimming, even cut the abstracts to the purpose, the aim of the study, and the conclusions, because it's really difficult to read scientifically written abstracts or even the whole papers, this time consuming too, to post them online and then provide the link for someone who wants to dig deeper or even read the full paper or request it from the authors, because all papers are not have no free access. So that way, and when somebody visits swims.wordpress.com, I can just scroll around and find some ideas about what tools exist to study swimming performance or the effects of swimming training, find new conclusions, create some new ideas, and maybe find new ways of testing. When you do a research, you probably test something, and maybe a coach can find this information useful, this test useful. Moreover, the results can provide and the conclusions can provide knowledge to coaches about new findings that are particularly interesting to them. You know, when coaches of all sports are asked about their preferred way of updating their knowledge and, learning new stuff, because of very little spare time, they usually answer that my preferred way is to, talk to other coaches, to view some videos on the internet, or to listen to some podcasts. And it's rare to see somebody answering that, I love to read scientific papers or going to scientific congresses too. And this is just right. I mean, a coach should coach and a researcher should research doing yes. research. So, but I'm really happy because all these years, the latest years, more and more researchers are actively engaged in involved in applied settings, monitoring competitive or even professional athletes. And you know, research and sporting practices are coming closer and closer. And that's what I am trying to do in particular with swimming research and training. I mean, there are a lot of great ideas, a lot of successful training programs that will actually would need to be, you know, supported from with some kind of research. I mean, some training ideas that should be studied and then scientifically prove that this method is correct or has some drawbacks. And there are some research ideas that provide useful information that probably some coaches would like to know, but don't know that this information exists. Yep. So it's really interesting to put these things closer, research and training practice. And I'm really into this. And I think as the years go by, they will come closer. There are a lot of great researchers actively engaged in coaching and monitoring athletes, and now coaches that are researchers. So I don't know which which comes first for everyone, but for me it's actually I'm in the middle. So I think that more and more things will come up from the closeness of research and training practice, and I hope that we will be a part of that.
That sounds fascinating, and as I say, as we move through the next few decades and everything else, the intelligence out there for coaches, we hope will get far greater, and that relationship between swimming coaches and the science will become, you know, a very close bond.
Yes, indeed. I mean, science can, you know, definitely help the job of coaches, the performance to improve. There's no doubt about that. That's actually what we're doing as coaches is based on scientific findings. Okay, it's that is clear. And additionally, coaches, and particularly swimming coaches, are continuously seeking for new ideas, new training methods, new ways to help their athletes. And you can see that about how many people, you know, listen to the podcasts, taking part in seminars and conferences. It's, you know, it's competitive, so you have to be better and better every day. And both researchers and coaches are really want to get better, and if they collaborate, they will get better faster. You know, researchers have to understand coaches, and coaches have to understand researchers. So, if we help this connection, it will be good for all of us.
Absolutely, yeah, couldn't agree more. The next topic we're going to move on to really is about the misconceptions about the body's production of lactate acid and the experiences of fatigue. Obviously, there's a lot being written on, words and terms like lactate threshold, et cetera, et cetera. Perhaps you could talk us through some of the misconceptions.
Okay. For years and years, lactate was regarded as a metabolic waste product that and its accumulation was considered as a main factor of fatigue. But in recent years, lactate has proven to be a very important molecule in our bodies. It's now disconnected from fatigue. Although still some believe that lactate can cause fatigue based on some findings, more and more people now understand that it's not lactate that is responsible for fatigue. Other metabolic waste products maybe, other factors like the depletion of energy substrates, neuromuscular fatigue, imbalances in minerals, etc., etc. It's not what we want to discuss today, but now lactate is not considered as a fatiguing molecule. Moreover, lactate now is considered as, and I think that this is really great, apart from being an energy substrate, boosting up gluconeogenesis, lactate is an important signaling molecule. And the accumulation of lactate when somebody exercises with some kind of intensity is actually the accumulation of fatigue is important to, you know, to for metabolism, for chemical reactions to proceed and then cause some adaptations to then give to proceed some signals to other biochemical molecules to go on with some important functions in our body. I want to keep it as simple as I can. So the body can adapt to the training stress and become better and better. So put behind the myth that lactate is bad. We have to really put behind the myth that when you do a hard training set, it's lactate that keeps you tired in at night or the next day. Even after a very hard training set that you can that is able to make the body produce a significant amount of lactate, and you can measure up to 20 or more millimoles per liter in blood, all this lactate will eventually go out, will eventually be metabolized, and after about an hour, the most, you will be back to baseline concentration of lactate. So it's not lactate that keeps you tired the next day. I know that most people that will listen to this podcast will probably know that, but I keep listening to that. I'm being asked about that when I do a heart training session, then I have to do some recovery sessions the next days so I can get rid of lactate. I really need to do some recovery sessions, but not to get rid of lactate. Lactate will be in very low concentrations after an hour after the training set. Moreover, some people do believe that when you do some exercise and you come up with high lactate concentrations, this is not good, this is really stressful. That's probably not the case. We must understand what an exercise set, a training set aims for, and then we will decide if we want high or low lactate concentrations. This is a training thing. But from a scientific point of view, the concentration of lactate helps other functions progress. So now the scientific point of view turns to, okay, we did a training set and lactate has increased in our muscles and then in our bloodstream. What does it mean? It's not fatigue, but it means something. So we're now digging deeper about what lactate serves us for.
Sure.
If you understand what I mean. It is really interesting, and a lot of research groups are now into this, and I think that the coming years we will learn more about lactate and the usefulness of it.
That's incredibly in-depth analysis. Thank you, Thanasi. Finally, I mean, the ways in which, sort of as a corollary to those misconceptions, the ways in which we can really sort of lactate threshold is monitored to improve swimming performance is something that all coaches obviously are, aspiring to achieve.
Okay, let me start by saying that from a monitoring point of view, lactate measurements, lactate testing is a great tool in coaches and scientists' hands. I mean, you can get a lot of information when you do lactate testing. When you come up with lactate concentrations, however, after a training set or a race, it's not the value that you only have to, you know, search for the lactate concentration, but the why behind this value. Why do we find these values after a training set, after a test set, after some, you know, graded test sets that most people use? The why, and is that generates, and you know, the ideas, the knowledge behind the lactate value. So lactate testing is really, really useful, and we really need to try to make it more accessible to more coaches in more levels, not only in high in elite swimmers. But let me tell you the biochemist's point of view about thresholds. If it is aerobic or anaerobic threshold, if it's first or second lactate threshold, a lot of researchers believe that we're searching for something that may not exist. I'm really not into these threshold methods. I mean, the word even threshold is misleading. Some people believe that when you say anaerobic threshold, and the intensity surpasses anaerobic threshold, then the effort becomes anaerobic. There is no aerobic solely or anaerobic only effort. It is always both aerobic and anaerobic, and it's which system dominates and provides more energy at every time, because you say, now I'm doing only aerobic training and then only anaerobic. I mean, it's always both aerobic and anaerobic metabolism working, providing energy. Maybe aerobic metabolism is dominant in some cases, or anaerobic metabolism is dominant in other cases, but it's always both of them working. So there's no jumping from aerobic conditions to anaerobic conditions. It's like a continuum, and you have to understand that really threshold is something that a lot of scientists have come up to describe a point on the lactate to speed, lactate to intensity curve. So when you are doing, the gold standard test in swimming is 7 200 meter bouts with a increasing intensity, incremental graded tests. It is the gold standard. Maybe some prefer 5 200 meter bouts, but let's take this for example. And you take a lactate measurement after each bout, and then you have to draw the curve with the lactate and the intensity on the axis of the graph. This curve is really, really informative. And then when people were seeing that after some point on the curve, lactate accumulation was increasing very fast. So they call this point as anaerobic threshold, for example. But it's really a point on the curve. So then after anaerobic threshold came maximal lactate steady state, another point on the curve, or maybe critical speed, or maybe the intensity, swimming speed in particular, that corresponds to a concentration of 4 millimole per liter of blood lactate. So these are really interesting points on the curve. They are correlated with performance, but mainly with long distance performance, not with less with middle distance performance, and not with sprinting performance. So although it's very useful to do lactate testings and plot the curve with the results, it's really very meaningful to, you know, to prescribe the energy domains, the intensity domains, called training zones. So you get to know in which training zone each time the athlete exercises and trains. These are useful stuff, but when you go to check anaerobic threshold and you keep your focus only on one spot, you may be misled to wrong conclusions. What I'm trying to say is that because of now the abundant research available and the findings that these spots on the plot, I mean, anaerobic threshold, maximal lactated state, V4, the speed that corresponds to 4 mmol per liter blood lactate concentration, you know, sometimes these zones overlap because it's a very close spectrum, a very close range that this all these belong to. And when you actually question yourself, okay, what's the meaning of it, since it's an energy continuum, it's not a very clear spot, then you will eventually think that, okay, I need to know the which speed corresponds to its blood lactate concentration and help to design my training, but it's not that the anaerobic threshold per se, it's the most meaningful parameter. This is my point of view, because in exercise biochemistry, we don't really like the term anaerobic threshold or lactate threshold, but it, as a term, it has helped a lot of coaches and swimmers to understand basic things of energy metabolism, but then it has misled us to some wrong interpretations. For example, the much efforts of many coaches and swimmers training to improve anaerobic thresholds. We must sure. train to improve swimming performance, competitive swimming performance. So it's one thing to test and get the results. Yes, I'm really supportive of doing lactate testing, and there are many ideas. There are incremental tests. There are other tests that now come up, maybe step tests again, but with different distances. There are even new tests that try to seek the lactate concentrations when you swim easily, when you swim with maximum intensity. All these tests help us understand the metabolic profile of a swimmer. And we should try to do some testing regularly. But afterwards, we have to see which points really are of interest and which where we should place our focus. I don't think that anaerobic threshold helps sprinters or, you know, the most cool events, maybe more long distance events. We can say more if you want on that.
Yeah. Maybe that's for another podcast. Okay. very, very interesting. I mean, to finish in summary, really, have you got any sort of perhaps any tips on any lactate training sets that coaches could look to do?
Yes, I mean a lot. But when you say lactate training set, do you want some answers regarding sets that improve anaerobic capacity? You know, peak lactate sets or sets that improve buffering capacity? I mean, training the anaerobic power.
The aerobic.
Okay. If we need to improve aerobic capacity, my point of view is to swim at the low intensity zone. I'm more a fan of the polarized method of training, when you do about 75 to 80% of low intensity training, some 15 to 20 of high intensity training, and some 5 to 10% of moderate intensity training. That's correlates to anaerobic threshold training. So if you want to improve aerobic capacity, you have to swim in low intensity with a volume that's relevant to the level of the athlete. It's more of a higher volume with short stops. And when you have to improve anaerobic capacity, then you have to do some short distances, about 25 to 50 meters with maximal intensity. And then the rest will decide if the set is aimed for improving anaerobic capacity or if improving power. Long rest is for improving anaerobic capacity. Short rest is for improving anaerobic power. There are great examples when you talk aerobic, for the aerobic capacity, you need to put some more volume, some longer distances, 200 meter, 400 meter bouts, even more for distance swimmers. When you talk about anaerobic sets, you have to talk about 25 meter, 50 meter, or up to 100 meter bouts.
That's an excellent quick synopsis there. Thank you, Fanasi, on those examples of training sets. Well, for me, it's been an absolutely fascinating podcast. I've learnt a lot, you know, the work that SwimT does is brilliant at sort of trying to now bring, as say, this closer relationship between the sports science side of swimming and the swimming coaches. And you know, I do hope your work continues to go from strength to strength.
I hope so. It's just an effort to, you know, to assist you know, the job that we all do. We all love swimming, we all love to improve swimmers' performances, so why not do something that can help? Even if one coach gets some ideas, it will be helpful, because he will share these ideas later with us. I mean, it's about sharing, it's not about...
Absolutely. It's a very sharing community. Very sharing community. Yeah, well, thank you, everybody, for listening to the Poolside Pass podcast. And, of course, you can visit our website, www.thepoolsidepass.com. Thank you very much indeed, Fanasi, for your time today and your in-depth knowledge.
I thank you very much. And every time you want something more, I will be very happy to share it with you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.